Good morning. We're really excited to be here from Kansas City. I'm Shelley, and this is my partner, my new best friend, Ann. We partnered in 2005, and so much of this was a community-wide effort that we're both going to be giving parts of the presentation, flipping back and forth between us. We also have a lot of information in these slides, and because of that, won't have time to go through every little bit, but on the last page, both of our emails are there, and we would welcome any questions you might have. And the entire presentation is on the web as well, so you can check with it there if you have questions. This started with Blue Cross of Kansas City having a new program in place in 2005. We have a mission statement, which you would not be surprised to hear, is that as our leading health care insurer in the community, we wanted to provide affordable access to health care and improve the health and wellness of our members. In 2005, when this program launched, we had a broader goal, which was to also improve the health and welfare of our community. And while we're still even more focused on the community, our mission statement has changed slightly because we realize we can do more direct impact with our members, so our board decided to tweak that. But in 2005, we were looking at what can we do to give back to our community in a more financially profound way. And they developed a new community health and wellness program. It originally focused on areas that weren't already funded adequately by other Blue Cross projects directed to our own members or other community philanthropic giving. And those areas were in along the lines of childhood health and wellness, childhood obesity management, or obesity prevention. And we knew we had low rates in EPSDT, which are the well child visits for little kids and teens, and immunizations, especially adolescents. We had horrible adolescent rates. I had to check with our legal department before I even put the numbers on the slide. And I said, everybody else knows it, so it's in the quality compass in the state reports. But basically, our commercial HMO rate was in the high teens. Our Medicaid rate was in the cellar. Our combined rate was 6%. We were all over the place, depending on how much money we spent in doing HEDIS chases. And our community rate wasn't a whole lot better. It was 26%. And compared to the national averages, we had a good deal of distance to cover and a long way to go before we were anywhere in the ballpark of healthy people 2010 goals. So our first objective was, after we got the funding approved for the community wellness project, was to select a partner. Blue Cross is also FTE conscious. We are very aware of every little bit of overhead administration adds to our members' premium dollars, and adding an FTE in my department for a project leader was not an option. But we were allowed to look for a partner to help facilitate the legwork on the ground. We found Prime Solutions, who was at that time part of Primaris. That's our Missouri quality improvement organization for the federal programs. And we were looking for something that wasn't warming the ocean, but had an approach that was akin to the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's rapid cycle improvement process. Also results-oriented and outcomes-oriented, could define those and deliver those, and Primaris had those in spades. And also we wanted a partner that showed a very deliberate respect for other systems in our metro area. We are located, Blue Cross of Kansas City is located in Kansas City, Missouri, which is the main Kansas City, I say. But we straddle the state line with two counties in our service area in Kansas. So we share part of the state of Kansas coverage with our sister Blues plan in Kansas, which is in Topeka, about an hour and a half away from Kansas City. And while we're sisters under the Blue Cross umbrella, we're independent plans, and there's another one in St. Louis. So this was very much the greater Kansas City metro area. Because it's five counties, two states, innumerable cities, and smaller systems and schools, there were a lot of moving parts and a lot of initiatives that we thought we might uncover we needed to be very respectful of. Blue Cross did not want to come in with our 40% market share in the area and be seen as the 800-pound gorilla that was, this is what we want. We basically wanted an approach that was very respectful of all of those other partners and stakeholders that we had yet not identified. So complementary to our culture was very important to us. So then moving into the plan, I'll turn it over to Ann.
Good morning.
Prime Solutions was really privileged to work with Blue Cross and Blue Shield on this project, and I think they were quite insightful to recognize that they couldn't do it themselves. We started this out in planning four phases. The first one was an environmental scan, which took us about 6 months. Then we moved into an awareness and consensus building phase, where we brought in a lot of agencies to work together and to define a single mission. We moved into an action phase after that, and then an evaluation phase. So that's kind of what we're going to be walking you through here. There's a ton of information, so we're just going to be able to hit some of the highlights. But please ask us questions later. So as I mentioned, the environmental scan, that was sort of our fact-finding mission. We had to find out who was doing what, and I bet you know this in your communities, that there's a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. What we wanted to do was create some consensus and build some energy among all of those agencies. We also looked outside ourselves to find out what was going on in the nation, to look at what other experts were doing. We did a literature review, all the usual things that you do under an adolescent or under an environmental scan. And unfortunately, we confirmed that we had issues. That those numbers that you just saw that were part of Blue Cross were common to everyone, all the other health plans, the schools were struggling. We also found that we had a number of adolescents that were being over-immunized because of lack of records. Not probably uncommon to what you're finding. So in the first phase, we also conducted focus groups. We found that nationally at that point, this was in 2006, nobody had done focus groups with parents for quite a long time, at least not that we found published. Since then, the CDC has done some groups, and I think they've got some really good information published. But we felt like we maybe had some unique community issues that we wanted to address. So we put together focus groups of both urban and suburban parents, thinking that there might be some differences. And we also did provider group questionnaires and focus groups. And, you know, what was so interesting was that we found a lot of commonalities, that there wasn't really the barriers that we thought between urban and suburban and even the providers. Lots of myths and misconceptions. So, for example, I guess we had here a little quote from one of the parents. We found the biggest thing that was kind of a surprise to us was that parents relied on schools 100%. You know, in our world, I think we maybe rely on more of our primary care provider or some other source of information, but parents were like, if the school didn't tell me this was necessary, you know, I didn't pay attention. So in one scan, this is what we found, and this slide kind of tells it all. We divided up our barriers into those that were data barriers. As I mentioned, you know, we didn't have a really good tracking system. And again, remember, straddling state lines. Now you've got the Missouri State Immunization Registry and the Kansas State Immunization Registry. We had health departments that had registries. No one was talking to each other. And our students would frequently move. You know, if you've ever been to Kansas City, you can't tell which is Missouri and which is Kansas. And so people are moving back and forth. And oh my gosh, the data issues were huge. Second thing was health policy barriers. Guess what? Kansas has different school recommendations than Missouri does. And so once again, parents are confused, providers are confused, kids are confused. And we did, of course, find those areas of insufficient insurance coverage, those gaps. We have an immigrant population as well. And there are people who simply don't have insurance. And those that do don't always know that it's covered, you know, that immunizations are covered. So we had insurance issues. In terms of provider barriers, they found it difficult to reach the population. As our colleagues mentioned earlier, you know, adolescents have a lot of other priorities. And so, you know, getting shots isn't one of them. And parents are worried about many other things, peer pressure, you know, sexual issues, lots of growth and development kinds of things. And so it just is hard to reach that population. If an adolescent isn't ill, they don't go to see their physician as a rule, unless it's a sports physical. And I don't know how many of you have taken your child to a sports physical, but sometimes they last about 7.5 minutes, and you don't really get anything that's going to be helpful in terms of immunizations. So we had missed opportunities. We had a lack of consensus of immunization guidelines. And I, you know, I'm almost ashamed to admit this, but Missouri admits that they had to dispose of over $750,000 of VFC vaccine in 1 year as a result of poor handling and storage. So we know we've got issues there. And then on the adolescent side, kind of the whole things that we talked about, the busy schedules, things like that.
So we moved into the second phase. Okay, now we know how bad things are, and we also know what everybody's trying to do. And we said, you know, we got to pull everyone together. So fortunately, we were able to engage Dr. Daniel Fishbein, who at the time was an epidemiologist here at the CDC, to come into our area, and we sponsored what we call the Learning Exchange, where we shared all of this information. And the exchange, and the people invited to the exchange were more than 40 agencies. All of the health plans, the school districts, the health departments, there were community agencies doing work, there were schools that were there, the school district representatives. We really pulled everybody into one room and we said, okay, folks, here's the picture. Are you in with us? Can you help us out? What can you do to be a part of this? And in that learning exchange, we also listed what everybody was doing. We put them on great big whiteboards everywhere and said, and it was amazing what this health plan did and what that health plan did and what this school district did. And when you started looking at it, you thought, well, my goodness, we're doing a lot of stuff, but we're just not making it. So that was the biggest commitment to everybody pooling resources. So we had a charter, and I'm not going to read it out to you, but it is there right there on the slide. And we developed 5 goals. And those we consolidated into improving awareness among parents, adolescents, and providers, leveraging school health plans so that we can increase, again, awareness and the immunization rates themselves. We wanted to get a better registry system. We wanted to reduce the financial burden of immunizations for parents and providers, thinking about that reimbursement issue with providers, and also to engage healthcare providers through consensus guidelines, something that we could all agree on because we had all of these things going on out there. Then that allowed us to do physician education and performance feedback. We had 18 months to accomplish these 5 goals, or at least begin them, so it was a very ambitious project. The second thing we did was we developed what we call our divide and conquer strategy. We knew we weren't going to get this done by all 40 agencies moving in mass. It just doesn't happen. So we divided up our big group into 3 work groups. We had a school work group that was school districts and various other community representatives and the health departments. We had a registry work group, all the tech people that kind of took that one over and said, here's how we're going to improve data collection. And we had a physician consensus guidelines work group, which we actually had the privilege of working with an established group that had been doing other physician guidelines called the Kansas City Quality Improvement Consortium. And so we kind of gave them that task and they ran with it. The health plan work group and a media work group were added later. Again, as a way of getting work, you know, you think about that term work group. Those people were meeting every week. They were developing the action phase. They were implementing and evaluating. And then as a collaborative, all 40 agencies, we would meet monthly to just, you know, keep everybody on the same page. What's everybody doing? And we also use listserv communications and conference calls so that they were fully engaged. And I have to say, this is pretty amazing. We had no agencies drop out in 18 months. Every single one of them stayed with us. They were all excited, and they really did a great job. We co-opted best practices. We stole shamelessly. That's an IHI thing. We did it. We took whatever we could learn from someone else to jumpstart the program, such as the Give It a Shot program and the Georgia Grits community approach. And we did, again, a lot of consensus building.
So some of the things that when at Blue Cross we're into deliverables too. So what have you done for the community that didn't exist previously? Ann mentioned consensus guidelines in the physician and consensus guidelines work group. That was one of our very first deliverables. When we talked to parents, teachers, the provider focus groups, and our health plan partners and the health department partners, we spent probably 3 or 4 hours talking about what was our goal and how will we know that we got there. And what we realized we needed were consensus guidelines. Everybody knew everything about the immunization picture in Kansas City. These guidelines not only use the ACIP guidelines, they layered in what the Kansas and Missouri different school entry requirements were. They made the distinction between required immunizations and recommended immunizations, and they made the difference between ongoing shots for fresh adolescents versus the ones that work at the catch-up shots, which it made a 2-pager. The Casey Kick did an absolutely wonderful job. They were published on the web and in late 06 and disseminated among physicians prior to that, during that, and then in hard copy early in 07. The Give It a Shot toolkit, Blue Cross went out and bought 250 of these and distributed them to every middle school and nurse office in our five-county area. And then they were thrilled with it, and we actually used the school nurse work group as a selection group for the product that we wanted to put in the school nurses' hands. They really liked this, but had lots of questions, so we brought Nurse Chu, the author of the toolkit, to Kansas City for a workshop in November, which was very well received by our school nurses and their stakeholder guests. And then they shared among themselves through, as Ann mentioned, the weekly groups and the listserv, their own best practices, what they were doing. One of the things I may forget to mention later, so I'll mention it now, is that the Kansas City, Missouri School District school nurses were so energized by the support they were getting from the community and seeing some hope in this picture, they formed a committee among themselves to share internally their own best practices, which yielded some pretty amazing results that you'll see later in the presentation. But that was a best practice for us, just what they did among themselves by coming together as a group was amazing. I'm so proud of our school nurses. I don't know if any of you are school nurses, but I didn't know what I didn't know, and those people are amazingly committed, probably second only to health department nurses, but we really owe a lot to them. The other thing that Blue Cross developed was the immunization guide for the secondary school nurses. We got questions from the school nurses. We don't have, you know, a way to print the stuff that's on the internet because we don't have a printing budget. So we put it all in a binder. We made a binder for Missouri, made a binder for Kansas, asked the school nurses in their work group, what do you need? Put that stuff in there too. And it's on the website now with the Missouri Mid-America Immunization Coalition. We had a back-to-school retail campaign which ran last summer, telling moms and kids what shots they needed to get. These were posted by Ann's team all across our city. I thought it was brilliant. They put them in public libraries. I would have never thought of that. And we put something else in place. The United Way 211 has a resource guide database that if you call that number, we loaded all of the immunization clinics, dates, times, and locations, and then publicized that information. And we're going to be working with United Way of Heart of America chapter to try to keep that updated. And then I'll give this to Ann.
Continuing on, we were able to engage a pharmaceutical company to support school-based clinics. We just knew that if we could offer immunizations at school sites, we could get higher rates. We did this in the summertime, a month before school started, in hopes of getting their rates increased by the time of school entry. We partnered with both the Kansas City Health Department and the Kansas City School District to do that. And we had our students, I failed to mention along the way, our whole model was not to push this into the community, but to really engage parents and students along the way. So we had these student advisory groups that helped do the other poster that you just saw. They helped us do this one. This one, it's like, I couldn't even read it, but they understood what it was because it was all about their text language, you know. And we posted this like everywhere in schools and Walmarts and places like that. And we did radio station ads. We had one that was a Spanish-speaking station. The vaccine was provided through the health departments using the VFC vaccine. And the parent and student response was very positive. We did exit interviews at each clinic to see how could we do this better. And it was just overwhelmingly received. So it was very nice. We had to have interpreters at some of the clinics because of the non-English speaking students. So it was a lot of coordination. We gave out food and gifts and things like that too. That was fun. We also wanted to promote awareness and education in our community. And this is, again, throughout this 18-month period. We did a lot of professional education. Fortunately for us, the last CDC National Immunization Conference was actually in Kansas City. And so we were able to leverage that event as a public awareness. So we did like radio talk shows and TV talk shows and newspaper ads and things like that around just coalescing the awareness of immunizations and the needs around the event. And we also hosted a breakfast with a national speaker for our people, for our agencies that we wanted to engage. Dr. Tamara Coyne-Beasley from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine helped us with that to improve adolescent immunization rates. And then the last thing we did in terms of awareness was we engaged the school superintendents. Wow, what a powerful group. If you want to get something done in schools, clueless sometimes, I think, about what they needed to be focusing on, especially with the result of the No Child Left Behind Act. This no shots, no school is just in direct conflict with No Child Left Behind. And so for them to understand that this was important was a very big deal for us. We had lots of conference calls. We did continuing education with national speakers, and then we engaged the community referral system that Shelley just talked about. We also then developed the health plan work group, and again, maybe an untapped source when you think about it, because health plans do have an interest in improving immunizations as well. It's one of their HEDIS requirements, and so you might want to think, if you haven't already, about engaging your health plans in this effort. But they were trying to figure out a way to get common data files so that schools could share data with health plans. Now, if you've got a good registry in place, it's probably happening, but if you don't, like we didn't, it wasn't. And we found we had a lot of issues there that we still now need to work through. But we got a lot of education about things like FERPA and HIPAA and all the data transfer issues.
So this is just a picture of our model for SPREAD, which is an IHI model. If you're familiar with that, we thought we'd show you what our final product looked like. And then in terms of outcomes, saving the best for last, we had, as I already mentioned, 1,500 primary care physicians who received the guidelines and another 1,500 specialists in the area. 90% of our almost 200 schools in our five-county area got the Give It a Shot toolkits. We focused on the middle schools, but overall it was 90%. 68% received our immunization guide. 53% of the nurses in our area received immunization training at some of the workshops. We've kept track of who we impacted. Over 35,000 students and parents were impacted by the resulting Give It a Shot interventions at school, back to school registrations and that type of thing, where those posters and materials were used. We had 6 of the area's 27 school superintendents who were initially impacted, and we're going to be hitting them again at another meeting later this spring with these results to try to show them what can happen when they're behind this. And basically, as you can see, another 60,000 people impacted through the media campaign, and we had 6 different immunization clinics through the process. Our Blue Cross rates, we had a 4-fold improvement in our HEDIS numbers, as you can see here, for our combined rates. Still nothing to brag about, but it's headed in the right direction. We do think that part of this is it's too soon in the interventions to have some impact on our numbers, but we think that what we learned about where the data is helped us with some of this as well. But we're really thrilled with this. We had 4 pilot schools who signed on for the 18-month We'll Share Data With You project. 3 of those actually gave us their outcomes data. In 06, back to school, day 1, for the middle schools, these three of the four schools had 260 kids who were out of school for at the beginning of school because of lack of compliance, and 24 in fall of 07, so a 90% drop in that. An average of 14% of kids not in school first day, down to around 1%. It was just amazing. Again, remember, 2 of those schools were in Kansas and 2 of them were in Missouri. But Kansas City, Missouri School District, who I told you had this best practice nurse committee, had a 40% drop in not compliant students on day 1 compared in 07 compared to 06. The numbers are just staggering. With 11 students, were the only 11 students in October of 07, which is when they have to make their report on their immunization status to the government. So I did some math. I found out that the reimbursement rate Missouri schools get per day per student for what I call butts in chair is $23.50. If those 1,100 kids missed on average 3 days of school, which is probably not anywhere really what they miss, because the nurses say most of them are back in 2 days if they're out this year, which is an improvement from last year. Just 2 days or 3 days, it's more than $77,000 in additional revenue that would have been lost had the program not had this impact. That $77,000, I don't need to tell you, will more than pay for a school nurse and her benefits or his benefits and supplies. So the last bit that we'll just breeze through very quickly here is maintaining the momentum. One of the most important things I think we did from Blue Cross's perspective is to make a way for this to live on in the community. Our 18-month partnership was almost over, and we wanted to know if folks thought it had value for moving forward into the future. They said, yes, absolutely. We're not done. We want to do more. So we gave Ann the great big challenge of plan yourself out of a job. And she did. And in 6 months, we transitioned the entire project and 5 work groups to the Mid-America Immunization Coalition in Kansas City area, which has 400 community agencies members, stakeholder members. Some of the next steps in 08, we're partnering with the St. Louis Coalition through the MAC. The MAC is doing this, MAIC. We're updating our consensus guidelines and our materials that we already did. We know that nurses move around. We're trying to find them and make sure that the new nurses in those middle schools still have a toolkit. If they don't have a toolkit, we'll get them another toolkit. And we're working with an HPV immunization campaign in our area. There's an old video we're redoing and making it in Spanish, Wally Takes Charge, focusing on adolescent immunizations. We have the registry work group, which is still being led by one of my colleagues at Blue Cross to integrate the bi-state and across county efforts to talk to each other. One of our biggest challenges for this year, because the 2 state registries aren't ready to talk to health plans in their development, is to get billing systems for the school systems and the health department so that they can bill back and forth to health plans. If we can do that, we can get that data and load it to our other databases and kind of maybe jumpstart the data sharing process. So thank you.
Well, thank you both for those great presentations. And you may have noticed during both presentations there was reference to the Give It a Shot materials. If you're interested, they are produced by the American School of Health Association, and they actually have a booth at downstairs in the exhibit area, in the not-for-profit exhibitor area. And if you go by there, you can give them your business card, and they can send you a copy of these materials. So please check out that booth if you have time. And it's the 2008 edition. So it is being updated. So I'd like to open it up for questions. If anyone in the audience, please come up to the mic to ask your question.
And while we're waiting for questions, Linda, would you stand? This is Linda Boyer-Chu, who is the author of the Give It a Shot Toolkit that both of us mentioned, and how wonderful to have her here.
Hi, I'm Sherry Newsom. I'm from the Cherokee County Health Department here in Canton, Georgia. My question is for Ann or Shelley. How receptive was the Board of Education and your whole school-based immunization program? We're finding that they're not receptive at all. That's our biggest challenge.
We didn't talk to the actual board. We never got in front of any boards. We went through the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce Superintendents Forum. It's a closed meeting for just the superintendents, and we got on their agenda. The boards of education, it's all about the school statistics and the money. We are hoping with the financial savings that this can bring to them that they'll see a different picture of what no shot, no school might mean to them. It's definitely the number one hurdle, our nurses said, was getting the administrators behind it because they're caught in a pinch. This is the number one, director of pupil services for the Kansas City, Missouri School District, getting their immunization rates up is his number one goal this year, though, based on the preliminary results. And he's got the support of his administration for that. So.
And consider also that boards of education and school superintendents are political animals, so to speak. And so by going through the chamber, you have business leaders that are placing pressure upon them to get those rates up. And that says a whole lot more.
And I would just like to add that we made contact with the supervisor of health services as the lead contact in a district. And once we had her buy-in, we had entree into the school district in an otherwise tough organization. So she was great. We put her on our steering committee, and she's been a real advocate.
And One thing I just wanted to add, tomorrow at 10:30, there will be a workshop about successfully partnering with schools and the university system. So it's at 10:30 in the Crystal Ballroom. So for those of you interested in working with schools, you may want to check that one out.
Thank you for your presentations. They were very informative. I'm from Chicago. I'm AFIC staff with the Chicago Department of Health. And we, in 2007, began an adolescent immunization assessment project. And we're using COCASA as well. And we found that if you use the reasons not given category, that it will calculate. If you say reasons not given and you say varicella, history of varicella disease, it will calculate it as the child having had the varicella vaccine. So you can, and we have a booth downstairs. We do have a poster presentation, and I will be probably leaving before you finish. So I'm going to just give you one of our handouts.
Just wanted to find out if you had school laws in Kansas requiring immunizations for school.
The first part of the question.
School laws. Do you have school
laws?
Yes,
there are laws on both the Kansas and Missouri side, but they weren't the same laws. They had different recommendations. But yes, there are. And but what we heard from a lot of nurses informally, especially, was, you know what, they are, but they're not enforced. Again, that fear of the no child left behind and the financial impact. So it was important to engage everybody in that discussion.
That is what brought the District of Columbia together. We found out that the school laws were there, but they weren't being enforced. And so the superintendent got on board, and now they're giving us data, the enrollment files, weekly. So we're able to match this data. We now have compliance rates of 97.55%.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we also have a coalition who has assisted us. What we do at the end of each year is we do a recognition or appreciation for all the school nurses, and we've expanded it to all schools, not just public schools, but all schools. Yeah. And the first year we did it, we had 68 schools that reached 90%. Each year we've raised the bar, so this year we're up to 98%. We already have 87 schools that are at 98% of 153. And also our coalition is very active. I see our coalition member, Monica. Very, very helpful. They organize this appreciation activity, and so we're able to get, you know, the school nurses are competing with each other. And it's really an exciting time for us.
Very good.
Hi, I'm from Niagara Falls, New York. Barb, I have a question for Barb. The judicial juvenile justice system, it's a great connection. I've never heard that before. Do you have any problem getting consent for the children that are in the system? I figure that's a big problem, like, especially with the day. I'm like, are they under custody to the state, or some of them are? Or?
They're not. In the juvenile justice system, what I learned are detention centers, juvenile justice centers, and jails are three different entities, but they all work under one umbrella. That was a big eye-opener for me, because I just always thought detention center, jail, and that's where the kids all went. Mm-hmm. But and this was developed, in fact, they now have a system out there, some kind of a program, it's called JDIC, and that's to get the kids before they even get into the system and give them skills that they're able to stay out of the system, and they're finding that is actually lowering the amount of kids that come in. Our biggest consent issue in the juvenile justice centers, they do not have blanket where the warden or the school or the superintendent of that system is the warden of the child is not the ward of the warden, like it is in a jail system. They still do have to go back to the parents and ask for permission. Now, if they do a blanket, what we're coming to grips with are blanket consents. Let's say if your child is in the system, they have to go for physicals, they get medical care. Part of that medical care will be immunizations. And that's how we worked it. But our biggest issue right now to date is with the lawyers for the system, yeah. Where the registry, we try to get them on the registry, but because they're trying to get the kids that are still 18 in that one little block there to get them to turn 18, and then they're able to use the registry for all the children. So because we have there's dated parts of the registry. So that's our biggest issue right now to date, is to get them to use the registry.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Alicia Tindall from the beautiful Commonwealth of Kentucky. And I'd like to ask you if you could comment briefly on exemptions and the impact that they have had on your adolescents. Kentucky currently has medical and religious exemptions only, and it is an issue that we sometimes face.
For the HEDIS health plans, there's the HEDIS specifications have rules about handling exemptions and contraindications. Actually, Anne's a HEDIS expert, too. If you have questions about what specifically they are, I'm going to turn it to her. And I'm not, I know the schools probably do because we've heard about those, but I don't know exactly what those are and how they're calculated into the results. Do you know more?
Yeah, I know a little bit more from the school perspective, and that is that if a parent refuses, then they are allowed to refuse. I mean, there's a parent, or and what happens often is the undocumented population does not get counted. So while, you know, rates can look good on paper, and this is one of the things that we discovered was that, you know, our schools were reporting, oh, 100% of their students were immunized. You know, we'd go in and we'd look at these other rates and go, wait a minute, there's something wrong here, you know. And that's because what they report, at least in our states, was that immunization's in progress, first of all, and they also don't count any of the exemptions. So not included. Yeah.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm Karen, and I'm from California, and I had a question regarding your no shots, no school policy and the close work that you do with the school nurses. With our adolescents, do you have separate school law requirements for adolescents, or should not have these been met at kindergarten?
They have... oh gosh, I knew I was going to get a nursey question. sixth grade entry, and they're different on the Kansas and Missouri sides. But basically, those Hep B catch ups and the chicken pox and DTaP.
Yes, so to answer your question, yes, there are different ones mm-hmm. by school entry in mm-hmm. kindergarten, and then again in sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Colleen Haggerty from Concord, New Hampshire. So do your school nurses go, do they have to send in a survey every year?
Yeah.
And they report it to the state? And does anybody go back and validate that? You do.
Yes, but again, it's reported as in progress. So if they've had one in the series of hepatitis, for example,
so
that counts as
conditionally enrolled.
Their compliance.
Okay. And it's a small sample of a small number of schools. So it's not 100% audit of all schools.
Okay.
So it's random.
And you have a philosophical exemption in your state, so not just medical, not just religious, but a philosophical one.
Just, okay.
That for exemptions, we require that each year we get a renewal for the exemptions so that, you know, it's not continuous. They have to send their renewals
That's
in each year.
Idea.
And the other thing is that we, back in 2002, when we did an audit of the schools, all public schools in the District of Columbia, and we found immunization rates were 40%, you know, when everybody was saying they're at 100%. So we started from there to put that data in our registry, and we're able to use our registry to build the rates to 97%.